Today's reading is from Matthew. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, "Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you." But he answered them, "An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so for 3 days and three nights the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth. The people of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the proclamation of Jonah. And see, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to listen to the wisdom of Solomon. And see, something greater than Solomon is here." The word of God for the people of God.
Welcome. In just 5 short weeks, we will teach you how to have a successful relationship with zombies. First, how to recognize a zombie. Grungy clothes, missing limbs, and a very limited vocabulary. And the last and most important one, they want to eat your brain. Now, there may be zombies who don't necessarily look like zombies. They may dress nicely, walk nicely, and have very complicated vocabulary. We'll talk in the coming week about how to successfully deal with zombies. But for now, you only need to know one word: distance. The key is to put as much distance as possible between you and the zombie. Going in for a hug? No. Putting up the old stiff arm? Yes. Do your best height, I suppose, and get out of there. Well, that's all the time we have for today. See you next week.
Well, aren't you glad you came to church to learn how to get away from a zombie? I invite you to take out your outline for the message this morning. I admit, this is probably the most unusual series title I've ever preached, How to Love a Zombie. But have you thought about how crazed our culture is right now with the whole phenomenon of zombies? What's the number one most popular television show in America right now? The Walking Dead. Most popular show in America about zombies. Think about some other movies that have been out in the last few years. Brad Pitt starred in a movie about zombies, World War Z. And another one that is very popular is called Zombieland. And I didn't know about this next one. Dave Williamson pointed it out to me. There is a movie called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Now, you know something has become a craze when you turn a Jane Austen novel into a zombie movie. I mean, it's just ridiculous. There's a show on Saturday mornings on cable network called Zombie House Flipping. Just unbelievable. There are video games about zombies. In fact, the most popular video on YouTube is a game called Plants vs. Zombies. There are zombie runs. You don't just run a 10K now. You do a zombie 10K where people come out of the bushes, and so you've got to run away from them as they're chasing you. There's a drink called a zombie, but as good United Methodists, we don't recommend it to you. Now, why would we bring zombies into church? Well, let's just start with a definition of a zombie. I got to give Mark Squire credit for this. He was in a meeting talking about this series the other day, and I believe, Mark, these are your words, and I thought, this is a perfect definition of a zombie. A zombie is death masquerading as life. Death masquerading as life. The outward appearance is alive, but inside, kind of dead. What do zombies want to do? They want to take the life out of you. So with that, let me ask you, do you know any zombies? Do you know any people who take the life out of you? They drain you. They make life difficult for you. Most of us, we don't need help loving people who are easy to love. It just comes natural. But we all need help loving people who hurt us, loving people who are difficult, even in relationships when they become difficult. That's where we need the help, isn't it? So this series isn't about zombies. It's about relationships. Even Jesus had to deal with difficult people. Most of the time, those difficult people were called Pharisees and scribes. They made life difficult for Jesus because they were threatened by him. Isn't that what happens most of the time? People who are threatened by you start to attack you. And that's what they did to Jesus. They started to attack him and look for ways to prove him wrong. Have you got any folks in your world like that? People you feel like they're just always trying to prove you're wrong. Do you live with any? No, I have to answer that. So one day, as these people were trying to prove Jesus was wrong, said, "Give us a sign. Show us something miraculous that proves your identity as a Messiah." Maybe Jesus had just had enough of it, but he said, "I won't do it. The best sign I could give you is the one that you already have, the sign of Jonah." Jonah? What is it about Jonah that proves who Jesus is? So to understand this story, we obviously have to understand Jonah. And when you start looking at the story of Jonah, you begin to realize it's a great story to talk about what it means to love people who hurt us. It's a great story to think about on this 15th anniversary of September the 11th. The story takes place in the 8th century BC when a northern aggressor called Assyria, an empire, swooped down and conquered Israel and besieged its capital city of Samaria. And God called a prophet in that century named Jonah to go to the capital of Assyria called Nineveh and begin to preach to them. And Jonah did not want to go. Why? Well, the Assyrians were known for their barbaric treatment of conquered enemies. They tortured people for amusement. They burned and impaled people alive. In the king's palace in Nineveh, some of the rooms were said to have had the skins of people as wallpaper on the walls. Would you have wanted to go to Nineveh? What would Nineveh look like today? Could it be the nation of Syria, where there are people there who have been responsible for the murder of thousands upon thousands, including small children? What if God said, "I want you to go and be my emissary in Syria"? What if God said, "I want you to go to a camp of ISIS, maybe even the very camp responsible for the beheading of Indianapolis' own Peter Kasich? I want you to go there and preach to those people"? Would we not want to go to Nineveh either? Sometimes Nineveh isn't such a faraway, fearsome place. Sometimes Nineveh is the office down the hallway, isn't it? It's the place where that coworker or that boss is who has hurt us and wounded us. Sometimes Nineveh is the home of that relative or that one-time friend who hurt us deeply. You see, the trouble with being obedient to God is God will sometimes call us to go to places we really don't want to go. Jonah did not want to go to Nineveh, so he went the opposite direction. He went to Tarshish. Now, where's Tarshish? It was a city in Spain known for shipbuilding. It was located along the Mediterranean Sea. Today, it's probably a beautiful coastal resort, the kind of place we might go for vacation. Have you ever been to Tarshish? I'm not talking about southern Spain. I'm talking about a place you go to get away from whatever God is nudging you to do. A place you go to take your mind off of those people who have made life difficult for you. And when you start to feel God say, I want you to make some repair there, you go, I can't deal with that. I got to get away to Tarshish. Maybe it's a real place. Maybe it's a cabin on the lake. Maybe it's just a quiet spot in the neighborhood. Some place you go just to get your mind off of it. Sometimes Tarshish is a good to-do list. There's nothing like a list that says, I've got other responsibilities I have to tend to before I can apply the energy necessary to face that difficult person. Funny thing is that that to-do list always seems to keep adding things that get in the way of that task. Maybe Tarshish is television or the gym. Just any place we go to avoid facing the people who cause stress in our lives. And the problem is you can't live in front of the television, or at least we're not meant to. You can't live at the gym. You can't stay on vacation forever. And God calls us to go. Have you got a Tarshish? If you've got a Nineveh and you have a Tarshish, then you're probably going to discover what Jonah discovered, and that is you can't get away from God. If God wants to take you to a Nineveh and you want to run to Tarshish, you're going to find that God is like a stalker who does not let you off the hook. So Jonah's on a ship going to Tarshish, and they come into a storm, and the sailors believe that they're not going to make it through. They're going to sink, and they're all going to drown. And they ask the logical question, who here ticked God off? Who has made God so mad that we're going through this trouble right now? And Jonah, he finally just said, okay, it's me. It's me. I'm the reason. I wanted to go to Nineveh. I'm trying to get away. Throw me overboard. They didn't want to do it at first, but the storm didn't end. So they said, hey, it's us or him. They tossed him overboard. The storm calmed down. The sailors were spared. A great fish swallowed Jonah. He was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. When is another time you can think of somebody being encamped in darkness for 3 days and three nights and then reappearing? We'll come back to that in a moment. Eventually, the fish hurled Jonah up on the shore. Hurl is the key word there. And Jonah said, okay, I will go to Nineveh. So he walks through the city that was so great, it took 3 days to walk from one end to the other. And he started preaching. 40 more days and Nineveh will be overturned. And I can almost hear Jonah's commentary. I sure hope. I can picture him saying those words with a sneer on his face. But instead of getting offended at this foreigner preaching, look what it says. The Ninevites believed God. When the king of Nineveh heard about Jonah's preaching, he called for the whole city to fast and pray. And they turned from their evil ways. Now, here's a key to this whole story. This is an important point to take away. To miss this point may be to miss the point of the whole thing. God was in Nineveh before Jonah was. God knows when a person's heart is softening. God knows when an individual is lowering his or her resistance, when they are vulnerable to a change. And when God knows that the time is right, God sends people to go and be the voices of reconciliation. And here's the toughest part of the whole thing. The voices God usually calls to go and speak to an offender is someone who's been offended. I don't like it any more than Jonah did. But God often calls the people who have been hurt to be the ones to go to those who have hurt. and extend reconciliation. Those are the voices with the greatest influence potential. And Jonah did not want that to be his voice. In fact, in what happens, we finally come to the declaration of what God did. God had compassion. And that's what made Jonah angry. He said to God, I knew you would do this. Dadgummit, I knew if I came here and preached to these people, you would let them off the hook. I knew you would do it, God, because it's in your name. You can't help but forgive people. You know what Jonah was saying? Sometimes, God, I wish you would act more like me. Look at this quote from Anne Lamott. You can safely assume you've created God in your image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do. That's a safe assumption. I mean, sometimes don't we wish God would hate the same people we hate? The people we say we have a right to be angry and to demand justice. We have a right. And for God to relinquish that right, it just builds up an anger toward God. Now, this is where the story gets kind of comical. Jonah climbs up on a hill so that he can watch the fireworks. He's looking out over the whole city of Nineveh, and he's waiting for God to rain down fire and burn the city to the ground. While he's sitting there in the hot sun, God causes a vine to grow up and provide shade for Jonah, and he appreciates the shade. But the next day, God causes the vine to die. Now Jonah's getting burned up by the sun. And he says to God, I am angry enough at you right now to just die. And that gives it all away right there. That gives it all away. Because that's what happens when we hold on to that desire for a hated enemy to get what they deserve. It hurts us. Remember that old scene from a Three Stooges episode where Curly keeps getting beat on by Moe, keeps thumping him in the chest. He finally has enough. Curly straps dynamite to his chest and says, ha, this will show him next time. That's what happens. We hold on to our resentment, our bitterness. We want to make sure they get what's coming to them. And what does it do? It makes zombies out of us. It just kills us in the meantime. So God ends the story by getting in the last word on Jonah. This is what God says to Jonah to end the story, and I'm reading now from the RSV, Rob's Standard Version. Jonah, how come you can change your feelings from pleasure to anger over a silly vine you did nothing to create or care for, and yet get upset with me for changing my feelings from anger to pleasure over a city of 120,000 people I created and will forever care about? See, this story now is not just about the Ninevites changing. This story is about Jonah changing. Jonah being willing to change his heart of stone because of a God who's willing to change. A God who is unwilling to just cast us off because of the offensive behaviors that bring about a certain deserving for every person, and who says, no, I will never cease to care about my children no matter what language they speak, what land they live in, what color of skin they happen to have. They're mine. They belong to me. I'll never stop caring about them. And if God's heart can change, He'll give us the power to change. You see, that's the model in this story. The model of this story is not about the capacity of human love. It's about the capacity of godly love to never quit on us. May 13 is known in the Roman Catholic Church as the Feast Day of Fatima. It commemorates the apparition of the Mother Mary to three shepherds in Fatima, Portugal in 1917. Next year will be the 100th anniversary. On May 13th, 1981, a gunman shot Pope John Paul II in Vatican Square and hit him four times. The Pope went through a five-hour surgery, lost a lot of blood. In fact, he credited the Lady of Fatima with his miraculous recovery and surviving of that event. The attempted assassin, Mehmet Ali Aka, was already serving time in Turkey for a murder he committed, but he escaped from prison and came to Rome, and that's when he shot the Pope. Shortly after the event, the Pope publicly forgave the gunman, but the Pope also knew that he had to go to Nineveh. He had to go to the gunman, Aka, and look him in the eye face to face and forgive him. This picture is one that's etched in the annals of records of Pope John Paul II's life, of him sitting nose to nose with this Turkish gunman, saying to him, "I forgive you." The Pope never talked about the details of that conversation. He never went into length saying what they talked about or what they said. It was reported that the gunman did not apologize, and he did not ask for forgiveness. But something must have happened. The Pope began to correspond with the gunman's family in Turkey, even up until the time the Pope died. He also started lobbying the Italian courts to release the gunman and set him free. He eventually took his case to the president of Italy, who in 2000 consented and released Aka. He was sent back to Turkey to finish serving his time for that sentence there. And then eventually in 2006, he was released and set free by the Turkish government. It was reported that while in prison, he converted to Christianity. We don't really know for sure, but 2 years ago, he surprised a lot of people by all of a sudden showing up in Rome and coming to the Vatican for the first time since he stood in that place and shot Pope John Paul II. This time he had a bouquet of white roses. He went into the Vatican when somebody at the door recognized who it was. They called for security to come. He said, "I simply want to visit Pope John Paul II's tomb." They escorted him to the tomb and stepped away. He laid the roses on the tomb, but a cameraman happened to catch him mumbling a sentence in Turkish. "Thank you. The mystery of Fatima continues. Thank you, Jesus Christ." What's the meaning of the Jonah story? That there's one way to deal with people who hurt us, and it doesn't provide a future. It's the way of holding on to bitterness, of wanting people to get what they deserve, and that doesn't hold possibility. But there's another way. It's the way of God. It's the way of Jesus Christ. And with that way, there is a future. There is a possibility for a story to continue to be told. Jesus said, "You want evidence of who I am? Go back and read Jonah. For I have come to be the embodiment of a God who does not give up on humanity. I offer myself as a victim to a world that gets hell-bent on making sure people get what they deserve, even if it means I go to the cross. But in my cross, there's hope. And there's belief in a future possibility of a better way. This sermon does not tell you much of anything about how to love people who hurt us. We'll do that in the weeks ahead. We'll get more practical about it. But we really can't talk about how if we don't believe first that that way really is a better way.